Views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the staff or management of the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas podcast.
You can't do drugs before you come in and wait tables.
Yeah.
There were proteins left.
Yeah, like the coolers were full of stuff. And there was 4 months of abandonment. So there, put that in your imagination, and I'll leave it at that. So everything.
Who wants some chicken right now?
We found it. We drove about a half a mile down their dirt road, parked. They had a side-by-side waiting for us, and they said, hop in, hold on, with 5 wedding cakes.
Oh, no.
And so we had to take it down into a cow pasture.
Oh, no.
So we don't have a freezer and we don't have a walk-in. Okay. And so, yeah, we have a lot of prep to do. It's a small kitchen,
okay,
right? And we're only open for dinner. And so, and we're only open 5 days a week. And so what we try to do is we try to put so much effort into the back end of it to make things happen faster in the front end.
I say, look, you're going to fail. I don't care how you fail. It's how you recover from that failure that matters to me, not you do it. Now, after some point in time, you keep failing, and then we have to have a conversation, you know, about like what really, you know, maybe you don't need to do this or maybe you don't need to do that.
Welcome to the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas podcast.
You guys have to pay particular attention to the weather.
Oh, gosh, yes. If it freezes one more time, I think we're all going to pull our hair out. Because it's like, cover, uncover. Are we covering tonight? No, don't cover.
Here's your host, John Engelman.
Necessity. I'll get it right. I have not been drinking beer, by the way.
I have.
Jeez. Happy Wednesday, or whatever day it is for you, and welcome to the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas podcast. We appreciate you tuning in. Today, we head over to Rogers and Benton County's first craft brewery, Ozark Beer Company. And we talk with co-owner-operator Lacey Bray and marketing, plumbing, technology, lead guitarist, and assistant beekeeper Marty Shutter. He may not do some of those things, by the way. Lacey and her husband Andy Coates got the brewing bug in Chicago, where he worked for Goose Island Beer Company. After that, they took a year off to figure out what they wanted to do next, and in that time, they visited some tap rooms and got some inspiration. Lacey is from Northwest Arkansas, where her family still is, so they moved here. It took a while for Lacey and Andy to get a business plan and financing together. Once they did, all eyes were on the first brewery of Benton County. It took some time to educate the public and local law enforcement about craft beer and selling beer on Sundays, but the community took hold and rallied around them. You'll hear some really, really fun stories about that. Now, not so fun, COVID. And Ozark Beer had to turn on a dime, literally, in one day. Some of the strategy they learned is still being employed today, and it involves their small batch brewing. Have they returned back to normal? Well, no brewery has, but that's because of COVID lessons learned. Lacey tells us her thoughts on expansion and what was Ozark Beer doing at the Smithsonian last year. Enjoy talking to Lacey and Marty and hope you enjoy our interview with them right here on the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas.
Teachers are dynamic leaders shaping a new generation. They bring a variety of perspectives from diverse backgrounds, innovating how they teach to prepare students for our fast-changing world. They're skilled experts, discovering a universe of solutions, telling stories, inspiring, mentoring, connecting cultures, leading by example. Teaching is a journey that shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
Welcome back. We are on location. We are at Ozark Beer. A lot of people call it heaven. It's Ozark Beer. We are joined by Lacey Bray, co-owner, and Marty Shutter. He is the Swiss Army Knife. I know they call you marketing guy, but you're really more of the Swiss Army Knife of the operation. And I want to thank you both for having me. I know we've been talking about this for a while. So thank you for your time. And I'm excited to be here.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you. You guys opened in 2013, so congratulations on 11 years. That's a long time for an independent beer company. Tell me a little bit about being open that long.
Yeah, it really feels like a couple of lifetimes.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
with the pandemic thrown in there. And so I think that we, the first few years that we were open, it was really building everything and gaining some momentum. And then when COVID happened, it was like starting again. And so I feel like we've had two distinct like time periods.
Yeah.
But it feels like, I think this year going into like 2024, that it finally feels kind of normal and that we have kind of like eclipsed or moved through that period. And so,
awesome.
Yeah. So I think
there are a lot of smiles, by the way. When I walked in, everybody was smiling. And I thought, boy, something's happening here. People have hit the beer early. This is a great place. I'm coming back. Well, good. Well, let's talk. Let's go back to 2012. What were you guys doing professionally? And, you know, how did you decide it's time to open our own place?
Mm-hmm. Auntie and I were a little bit of kind of nomadic at, or I guess the period right before we moved to Arkansas, which would have been around 2010 mm-hmm. or so. And so Andy and I had met doing seasonal work out west in Colorado, raft guiding and ski seasons, that kind of thing.
Heck yeah.
And then in about 2007, we kind of decided that we needed to try to kind of figure out more of what we were going to do with our lives. And we ended up
been there.
Yes, exactly. And so we ended up in Chicago, and that's where Andy really got his jump start, really in brewing and the brewing process. He had worked at a brewery in Colorado before, but it was the packaging line. And so Goose Island in Chicago kind of started us out. I was doing Teach for America up in Chicago during that time, too. And so we were there for 2 years. And then after that, we decided to take a year off and try to figure out our next move. And so during that time was when we kind of traveled around and hit a bunch of tap rooms. And we decided at that point that that would be our next goal. And so in 2010, we moved to Arkansas, and this is where I'm from.
Oh, okay.
And to start a brewery here. And so it took us 3 years to get a business plan and get investors lined up that we needed. And so that was kind of how we kicked it off.
That's awesome. So now, are you from Northwest Arkansas?
I am. Oh, okay. Yeah. So I grew up about half an hour north of Rogers in a little community called Garfield.
Sure.
And so that's where my family still lives. And
awesome.
So yeah.
Awesome. Well, you guys were the first brewery in Benton County.
Mm-hmm.
All eyes on you. They had just gone wet.
Yes.
And you guys decided this was the spot. You're opening up here. What was the process? Because it's not like you had opened a brewery before.
Right.
And it's not like a brewery had ever been opened here before.
Mm-hmm.
So away you go.
Mm-hmm. We had kind of modeled the brewery after a friend had jumped over and kind of helped jumpstart Fremont Brewing up in like the Seattle area. And at that time, that brewery was just a warehouse space, and they would open it up on the weekends and have people come in and serve pints. And so that's initially how we started in the first location, was just being open on the weekends. We would pull out, we literally had like a hodgepodge of everyone's dining room table set that they were getting
yes.
rid of.
Yes.
And we would just pull out all of those into the warehouse space and like set it up for like Friday through Sunday.
I almost forget about that. At some point we got picnic tables and it felt so fancy.
Yeah.
Because every table was a dining room table with a different set of dining room chairs.
That is awesome. Please tell me pictures exist.
Yes, definitely.
Awesome. Well, good. Well, what was the first milestone? I know we talked about this before we hit record, but what was the first milestone where you thought, this might actually happen? We might actually be able to do this.
I think for us at that time, it was really when the community really grabbed hold and embraced us. And I mean, the first time that we were brewing, we had people drop off food for us with notes. I mean, the community was just so excited. And I think one of the first like large events that we did was Ping Pong for Paws. And we partnered with like the Humane
That's
Society
great.
And man, it was just so many people showed up. It was so much fun. And I think it was in those moments when we were surrounded by the community and kind of, I don't know, just felt like we were all in it together, that it was like, okay, I think we can go. Because you're right, at that point we were the first brewery, and so we were fighting so many
like preconceived notions of what alcohol was. And so one of the first, within like the first month or two that we were open, we actually had like an enforcement agent from the ABC show up and say, like, you guys are selling beer on Sunday and that is not okay. And at that point we were like,
but it was.
Yeah, we were like, oh, wow. Like legally we can sell beer on Sunday, but it was so new that nobody really like had gotten caught up. And so we did, we pulled out our law book with him and we were like, see, it says we can sell. And so yeah,
we had the same thing with cans at one point where when we first started selling cans, we didn't sell them on the weekends because we were like, well, you can't do it on the week. But for some reason, we thought we couldn't sell them on Sundays. And then Fossil Cove was doing, we're like, wait a minute, we can do that. There was, yeah, we same with kegs too. Like we could sell kegs on a Sunday, but it was such a wild west then.
Oh my gosh, it sounds like it. Like you have to continue reassuring yourself with your paperwork.
Yourself
like,
and your enforcement officers.
Yeah, well, I guess so, right? Yeah. That makes sense. Oh, my gosh.
I think for me, I remember, like, one of those, like, we would do music on the weekends, and we get, you know, music in a food truck, pretty standard, in a big open warehouse space. And I would always try to set the musicians up in such a way that, you know, if you were there for the show and you wanted to tune into the music, you could sit there. But if you wanted sort of casually to engage the music, we had plenty of room, you know, in the back part of the room or in different corners where we'd set up tables. Mm-hmm. And I remember one afternoon we had a group playing in the corner and there was a 4-year-old's birthday party in the back corner. There was a 3-piece string band over here. We had a barbecue truck out front. And then there was like people who were just traveling in who had, they really no access to any of that. They were just drinking the beer. And I remember that. Not as a moment where I'm like, this is going to work. But I remember being like, oh, like, it works now. Like
this is a thing.
Yeah, it's like if all these different groups of people can be in the same space for the same reason, what we're doing is working so far.
That's awesome. And you continued to build. Mm-hmm. And then some years later, the C word happened. Mm-hmm. COVID. COVID shut a bunch of people down. It shut down some accounts and, mm-hmm. and things like that. Yeah. And you guys found yourself in a position. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that. I'm looking at both of you now.
Yeah. No, it really was. I think that being in Arkansas, we watched it come in from both coasts. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like we were one of the last places to really get hit. And
absolutely.
So we had seen it coming and we had called, like, I just remember that week, we came in on a Monday and we were set up to go normal. And by Monday afternoon, we were closing down and doing a drive-through. And so everyone was so...
pivoted in a day.
Yeah. And I think the whole community was really proactive because we had seen it. And so it was really self-regulating at first where a lot of restaurants went ahead and closed. And I think... so naively now looking back, but we were just like, well, maybe if we all jump ahead of it and we close and take it very seriously, maybe it will go through quickly. For me at that point, I was looking at payroll and like, and I knew that we had just made payroll and I knew I had 10 days to figure something else out or we were going to have to lay people off. And I was calling our representatives like nationally and just being like, look, like this is what's going to have to happen. And not a whole lot of people were talking about it at that point and exactly what it looked like for different businesses. And I just remember thinking like, our staff is such a part of the community that if we do something drastic, if we have to lay everyone off, like we have to communicate that because otherwise, like it's just... people need to know and
sure.
And as a service to our employees as well, so that they don't feel like they're hiding anything. Like we just need to be honest. And it was really awkward. Like we sat down with Marty and I was like, before we announced anything. And I was just like, Marty, I need you to help me like read over this and write this as our announcement that we're laying people off. And like, and we have to lay everyone off, including Marty. And
wrote most of it. And it was like, on paper, it sounds awful, but we work so closely together. Like, I remember when watching it come in, I had just been in D.C. for like a week for a friend's birthday and seen had already seen it acting a little bit different. This was like March 14th, 15th, and then Tom Hanks got COVID, and then the world took it seriously. And we
that was in Australia too, right?
Yes, that's where he had it. Yeah. And we're often so far, we're planning so many things so far out. Some of the deadlines were hitting us where, is this conference going to happen? Is this festival going to happen?
Right.
Is this sports thing going to happen? Are we going to feel responsible inviting 200 people here in April? Mm-hmm. And that decision was really made for us on that sort of day, that around March 17th. And I remember we were in here and we decided we had to close the tap room. We knew our accounts were closing. And I think one of the cool things about our size at that time and this time too is we could pivot quickly, but also that pivot, we talked about this week, that
sure.
pivot actually had, it actually had impact. And so I do remember we had been watching it come in, and Andy and Lacey, we went upstairs together, and like everyone started crying, and Andy goes, this thing's going to kill us. And I was like, you think so? And he's like, yeah, this is going to kill us. And I was like, well, what do we do? You know, and they're like, well, we're going to lay everyone off, starting with you, and can you write the copy? And it was like, yeah, let's do it right now. Like, let's figure it out. And right before that, or maybe it was within that day, we got a quick permission to use space in our brewery for a drive-thru. So we permitted essentially a lane from one garage door to another. I ran and grabbed the computer. We created a website where we could do pre-orders. We created some copy that made sure it was legal. We weren't, you know, ordering, we were checking your ID. So we did a pre-order, we created a quick menu, ran out back, had Andy drive the bus around. We did a video to show where our drive-thru is. We created some signage.
Smart.
So literally, we came into the business, in the business we'd created for 6-7 years at that point. And by the end of the day, our taproom was closed, our distribution was essentially nil, and we had a drive-thru, and we had a website for it, and we had a bit of a protocol. In a day. Mm-hmm. And I look back on that and I think we were all like in a combo of, you know, save the ship. This isn't going to be as big as everyone thinks, but, you know, got to at least do something.
And right.
Because like, you feel like you got to do something. And I think that whatever that combo was of delusion, hope, and just, you know, just love for this thing, this baby we've created, I think that being able to pivot at that speed, even though we had to clean it up as we went on and add merch and where that took us, that really saved our ass. You know?
The train horn seems to agree.
Yes, and it will occasionally. That seems to be all we're going to get on that one.
That's great. Well, and there had to have been shock in there that we've got to do this now, or, you know.
And that I think we saw in our industry, locally some, but also nationally, was it's almost an exact correlation. Like the speed and, you know, whether or not people recovered is directly correlated to how quickly they embrace the change.
Yeah.
Because we're on three legs. We're retail, which is our kegs. We are in stores, that's cans, and so that's distribution. And then we're the tap room. And two of those legs were knocked out from under us within a day.
Ugh.
Which, you know, led to things we're doing now in terms of small batches and stuff, but it was quick.
And I do, like, we were able, our size allowed us to be super flexible. And so I believe at the time that COVID hit, we were about 70% draft in the market and 30% package.
Okay.
And then that switched overnight. So we
wow.
went to doing, I mean, probably like 90% in cans and package and only a very small amount in draft for probably the next year.
What we couldn't really plan for was that everyone was doing that. And like I said, they're doing at different speeds. So an existing, established, centuries-old aluminum market in steel
right.
was completely taxed within a day or two. And so we went from being able to order blank cans or even printed cans. I wasn't doing this. Lacey was doing this. But it was a relationship we had. And it was predictable, even if the pricing fluctuated.
Sure.
All of a sudden, everything was a shortage. Aluminum was a shortage, or a price increase. Steel was a shortage, or a price increase. We would hear from label manufacturers, not that they couldn't print in time. They'd tell us why. They'd say, there's no adhesive. Or the paper backing trucks didn't come in. Or somebody else outbid us. We were in the office one day tracking a ship from Sri Lanka, determining if someone was going to have to drive to the port of New York City to get a truckload of cans so we could meet a Walmart order a week later and stay open.
Wow.
So almost all these decisions that had been baked into, you know, just doing business became these like life and death decisions in an environment of complete uncertainty. And we're still coming back from the way some of our suppliers have reoriented. But yeah, the crunch on aluminum, everything went into cans, everything went into small batch, and everybody went from 30 to 70. So we were really lucky that we made that quick decision because we were just slightly ahead of the others for each other decision.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's round third on that. And how hard was it for you guys to prepare to come out of the pandemic when things started looking good and you're thinking, we got to start producing a lot to be able to fill the keg orders and fill everything else because we're coming back?
Yeah.
I'll be honest, with the package, that's kind of where all of our energy went for a long time and putting those small batches into package. And so I would venture to say that our industry as a whole, like, really never returned back to normal.
Okay.
I feel like somebody described it as like whatever small fires were like smoldering when COVID took place, it was like taking gas to them and just lighting them up. And so what we saw was huge disruptors in what people could get in a package. So it started with the seltzers a little bit before the pandemic, but they really took off during that time. And then we've also seen the growth of like canned cocktails. And so all of those things have taken a chunk out of beer or out of shelf space, out of people's just bandwidth to drink or do any of that stuff. And so, and then non-alcoholics as well, as we've seen like people become more health conscious. And so those things have remained huge disruptors in our industry. And like I said, I think that we are returning to something more normal this year. The draft sales that we saw before the market or before COVID really have never returned to the levels that they were. Like those disruptors still stay in place.
Okay.
And so it really is kind of a new world for craft beer. Yeah.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
But coming back, your community really kind of stepped in. The doors opened back up and away we go.
Yeah. I think like it was a weird thing where it was like it wasn't a light switch like the when we closed. That was very much open in the morning, closed at night. You could delineate that down to a handful of hours. The opening was really a bit of more of choose your own adventure for businesses, for people. Our biggest challenges were making sure that outside of the business world, but just as you know, getting the space back was, do we feel comfortable having employees back in the building? What sorts of steps can we take that aren't just perfunctory or, you know, window dressing, illusion of security, whatever? What can we do that, you know, we still have these air purifiers behind us, different cleaning protocols, I mean, things we were doing, I don't even remember at that time. So we brought those in to make our staff.
So much sanitizing.
Yes.
Oh, and then I forgot about that.
And then communicating that, right? Like we have hand sanitizers. There was a shortage of hand sanitizers.
For sure.
Like, but then communicating to the customers that we're taking this seriously. We don't have all the answers, but here's what we're doing. And it's sort of, if you feel safe, the windows are open, the tables are spaced out, the bar is spaced out. You can get beer to go still. We kept our pickup available for a while, so people who weren't comfortable, because it was really a mix of people who the entire pandemic would have come in here and had a 60-person party if they could, or the people who to this day are still, you know, like a little reticent about stuff. So it was we had to move at the speed of the customer's like reintroduction.
That's a great point, yeah.
It was a lot of communicating that we're taking this as seriously as possible, but we also have to be open. And we'd always been a company that used our space as a community space and with events, and that is where we had to. That's just where we had to go at that time. We had to really get people in here and try to find things that people wanted to do together.
Sure.
I think it's interesting. I looked at the numbers not too long ago. When you talk about community, like. I mean, I think that we are so closely tied with our community here in Northwest Arkansas. And if we would not have had the response that we did during COVID, I think we would have had a lot harder decisions to make.
Yeah.
When you look at that year that we were kind of upended, we were completely closed and could only offer to go maybe for the first month or 6 weeks of that period. And then for the remaining part of the year, we were at 30% capacity in the tap room. And when we look at our sales numbers for that year out of the tap room, they remain steady or we're down less than like 4% from the previous year.
Wow.
So when you look at how much less time and how much less product that we got to move through, but the community showed up to support us during that time.
So great.
Like, that's the only way that we came out of it. The only way.
We had to find ways. So, like, you know, you mentioned small batches.
And sure.
We talked about the drive-thru. It's like, for us at that time, it was, you know, five or six beers that were year-round or half a year to the occasional small batch, two or three small batches. And of those, occasionally one would be canned. We knew that that's what brought people to tap rooms, was like trying something they hadn't tried or trying something new, but tap room wasn't open. And so being able to pivot fairly quickly, we even bought a bottling line because the canning crunch was so obvious that it was coming. There was even talks of tariffs at the time, which was putting more pressure on the market. There were no tariffs, but the pressure was the same, so it acted as if there were tariffs. So we bought a glass bottling line. With that was a labeler, which we peeled off and put on to the canning line. So now, at this point, we were able to really lean into small batches. And so we had a reason. We were trying to, you know, we looked at those customers coming in, and so all of a sudden we could give them a reason to come back, you know, every few days or within a week or two, because we were putting those small batches in cans. And so all the infrastructure we built to respond is really the infrastructure we're using now to drive small batches in the market, you know. Yeah, we're still using that labeler. We have the bottling line just in case. Did we get rid of that? It's still in the corner.
No, it's still in the corner.
Still in the corner. Like, but the way we're operating now with small batches and an expanded tap list, we're really born out of COVID.
That's great. Am I the only one, and I'm going to date all of us here, I'm afraid. Am I the only one that thinks of the intro to Laverne and Shirley when I think of a bottling line? They put the glove
no,
on and wave.
People mention okay. it for sure. Right. But these have LED sensors, which will stop the thing if their sensor's a problem. They didn't have those.
No, they most certainly did not. You wouldn't have the glove on there waving either.
Just drinking all the beers on the line.
That's it. That's exactly right. Well, let's talk about expansion. I know right now you all are throughout the state, and I believe southern Missouri. Anywhere else? Am I missing anywhere else?
That's it.
So is that the plan, to stay that way, or maybe get down to Texas where my dad can get beer? Or...
Texans certainly ask a lot.
I'm sure.
I think for us, and one of the things that we've learned watching, like, just almost kind of the rise and fall of, like, the craft beer bubble, and really the issues that we saw begin in COVID really came home to roost for the craft brewing industry in 2023. We saw a record number of brewery closures and a record number of brewery mergers that happened. For the first time ever nationally, we had about the same number of breweries open as closed last year.
Woof.
And so these disruptors have been huge in our industry. And so I think for us that where we're at is kind of the sweet spot. Large regional breweries don't do as well as they used to because people have more options locally. And that's where people are really gonna choose to spend their money. And so for us being at this size, we have a little bit of room to grow, but I think that we are at a point where we just want to make this business sustainable. So that maybe it isn't so hard as it has been, you
sure.
know? And we can find a spot where it feels good and we can kind of get into a groove.
Plus, southern Missouri is part of the neighborhood anyway.
Oh,
absolutely.
Totally.
Yeah.
So.
And if in growth, like, can be territory, but it can also be, like, within the territory we already
sure.
have.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we always have grown. I think when she's referencing what's so hard is we do so much to stay right behind demand, so we're not over leveraged in equipment and salespeople and like trying to keep a ball in the air far away from where we live. Like when she talks about the regional breweries, that's like the competition, and then so the margin for those breweries always made sense to just send the beer far away because it's new, right? Someone on the shelf there, they're gonna see a bump in their sales, and if it works, they stay. If it doesn't, they don't. And then if it works, they can invest in sales and marketing, whatever, for that territory. Well, now the cost of keeping that sales and marketing in the air for a territory so far from the brewery and combined with the local competition has erased the good sense that made them in the past. And to the degree,
yeah.
again, that they've caught on or pulled out, like some of, like, it's different. You know, some breweries that are really large are moving a lot slower, and then they're seeing a lot more losses. Others that were able to just cut out of our market and focus on where they were at in Pennsylvania or Northern Colorado, I think those are the ones that are probably doing a little bit better.
One of the things that we've seen, like, much like everything, we have seen crazy inflation in our raw materials and specifically our packaged goods. And so we can only pass so much of that on. People are only going to pay so much for craft beer or buy it regularly. And so a lot of the margin that we used to have on packaged beer isn't there anymore because we've absorbed prices for cans and for labels and for your six-pack holders and your case boxes and that kind of thing. And everything. We're also seeing kind of our raw materials in terms of like malt and hops also go up because of like climate pressures, right? If there are wildfires, if there are droughts,
oh my gosh,
like that's affecting our materials to make beer. And so for us, all of those things have cost more. And so, yeah, to get our package into people's hands, we make a lot less money than we did before the pandemic.
But it's even more important to get the package in their hands and to be selling beer when our doors aren't even open. And, you know, we see that inflation, like where what happened so quickly is we were willing, if it was 13 cents more, 6 cents, whatever it was like, if we can get it, it takes precedent over that cost. And so we were able to, you know, keep moving along. What we're seeing, and I'm seeing a lot, are the suppliers that we have in between, they've reoriented to hold on to those prices increases as much as they can.
Yeah.
And so we have this sort of artificial, like, just grasping at straws to keep aluminum higher, to keep, you know, the way we print stuff higher, the everything. And so there's so much inflation in between, but it's been this holdover. Like when we used to buy printed cans, we'd deal directly with Ball. We'd deal directly with these people, and now we have brokers, and it doesn't need to be there,
right?
Because they're emailing the person we email, but the price increase remains.
So they've added a middleman.
Machines have come online. Facilities have come online. Aluminum didn't face the shortage or the death we all thought it would.
Yeah.
But the prices are still higher. So
insane. Insane. Well, before we jump to break, I've got to find out about the Smithsonian Folklife Festival last year, where Ozark beer was the official beer, I'm told.
Yes.
And Marty taught a beer class, or maybe several.
I did a few. So Smithsonian does a festival every year on the National Mall called the Folklife Festival. And this was essentially the 50th year. I think there was maybe 50. There was some math problems in there. But they were focusing on the Ozarks, and they had actually started the festival with the Ozarks in the 70s, and so it was sort of a return for them. They make a habit of bringing in as many people from these regions as they can, and as many different like makers. And one thing the Smithsonian does that we learned in the process was they don't try to come from D.C. and say, we want this list of X, Y, and Z. They try to find people on the ground to create what those lists are so they're more culturally and locally relevant, and they fill it out. And so when they approached us, it was sitting right here, and it was straight up a sponsorship thing. The top line sponsor was $1 million. The lowest was $10,000. We had neither of that.
Right.
And so they had never done a beer. They'd only served beer during this festival once, and they had just done it the year before, and I think the reason they reached out to us, they saw the financial benefit for them if they own some of those sales. So we countered with, well, what if we create a can, or what if we co-create something that you could own through your vendor, then you own those sales, or you own a portion of those sales.
You marketing guy, you.
Yeah, you got to make, we created the value for them all in a proposal where they could say, oh, this, if we work in such a way, we'll make more money than we're asking them for, and we'll have this cool thing. So we used it as a way to, we said, well, what do you want to, you know, we always ask, what kind of challenges do you have? What do you want to solve with this? And for them, they wanted to honor Dr. Olivia Cadaval, who's one of the preeminent folklorists with the Smithsonian Institute. And one of the production designers of the festival is Olivia Trimble from Fayetteville. She's a locally celebrated sign painter, artist, muralist. And she was working on some of the sign painting for the festival and a lot of layout. And being a friend of ours, like we asked the Smithsonian, it's like, can we call it the Olivias, you know? And they actually, can we honor both Olivias? And so they came back and said, yeah, let's call it the Olivias. Let's do the blurb. So, you know, each person that came, was there for a different reason, to showcase a different, you know, craft of the Ozarks or food of the Ozarks, historical thing of the Ozarks, music, dance, whatever it was. So we were kind of all over the place. We were a bit of a sponsor, a bit of a promoter, a bit of a beverage provider, and but they were kind of talking to us like a vendor, or as a presenter, as if we were, they were treating us a little bit more than, you know, just selling a beer, which is what we were doing. And so they gave us the opportunity to speak a couple times on the mall and do some different events with the festival to kind of, you know, add value to what they were doing, sure. But also, I guess, just, you know, round out our involvement. And so I did three things. I did a panel with, it was interesting, a panel on water quality with some distillers. They brought some distillers from Stone County with a still. And they were actually making corn liquor on the National Mall in a historic first.
How about that?
They side story on that. They transported a still from Stone County to D.C. through Tennessee. And the Smithsonian gave us all the opportunity to get a letter from the federal government that was a one-time exemption from, like, all laws. And if, you know, you could fly with ancient knives, or you could drive with whiskey stills and corn liquor through Tennessee, and it was a federally, you know, good letter. And those guys with the stills, I think they got pulled over in Tennessee, and they got to show it off. And he's like, I'm going to change the date on it and use that whenever I need it.
But hopefully it's not like the officer that came in here and said, you can't serve beer on Sunday. No. Yeah, hopefully they... That letter looks real. You go right ahead.
But they had a teaching kitchen, which was really cool. So you had, you know, one of my favorite chefs was Bradley from Tulsa. He's a he has like a Native American restaurant, or right. At the time did, and he does food for television shows like Res Dogs and stuff. And so he was teaching cooking classes of like Cherokee food. In the
area. Wow!
And then we had, you know, cooking over the fire, chili and stuff. And they wanted to do one about the beer. So we, you know, I told them, I said, we can't brew a beer in 45 minutes, you know, but they wanted me to have a pot and water and stuff. So I brought the yeast, the hops, I brought several of the inputs, and it ended up being more of a Q&A about, like, about the brewing process, but also about some of the thoughts that go into it. And then they asked me to do, like, a talk. They gave me 45 minutes on the mall. And so I used that to talk about the collaborative spirit of our industry and mm-hmm. the history of how... Our industry was built from people who were trying to figure it out together, and so created, you know, some operating practices which put pressure on, you know, different industries to adapt to us, which, you know, gave us share in the market in terms of, you know, beer stores or homebrew shops, which led to pubs, which led to standalone breweries, which led to, you know, roughly 1% of the U.S. GDP. And we were able to reference a single line that Jimmy Carter had changed in the 1976 appropriations bill that made homebrewing legal and essentially made it untaxed, which opened the floodgates to,
sure,
40 years later of 1% of the U.S. GDP. So that's the angle we brought, was that, you know, what's in a can is an American collaboration any day. There's a farmer from Montana. There's a yeast scientist from Southern San Diego. There's a guy working on the packaging line that grew up here. There's a guy working on the packaging line that grew up in Fayetteville. There's, you know, me making that label with my hopes and dreams. And there's the organizations that will benefit from that as well. So every can and the whole structure of our industry has been a collaborative story. And so we use that as a centerpiece.
And this is perfect timing, because when we come back, we will have the Mike Engelman Home Pro Tip of the Week, and we will be talking about beer, and we'll have that tip coming up next right here on the Flavors of Northwest Arkansas. As we do weekly, it is the Mike Engelman Home Pro Tip of the Week, and for those that don't know, Dad got on to me, said, I don't know any of the people you interview up there, and you still make me listen. Give me something I can use. I will tell you that my father is a Yellow Can Coors Banquet beer man. Has been since he had a fraternity brother at SMU bootleg it from Colorado back in the 60s. So that was considered a big thing back then. Obviously, you know, you can get it everywhere. Duh. But I will pass it to both of you for the Pro Home Tip of the Week.
What I'll say is what we were talking about. I've noticed in friends of mine, even in my own family, people who are, you know, loyal to a, and that's one thing we don't see so much in craft beer. We see people who are loyal to craft beer less than a brewery, whereas that is like, I'm loyal to the Yellow, I'm loyal to the Silver Bullet. I only drink Bud Light, whatever. if they're interested at all in what we're doing, I would suggest not to abandon the thing that is your favorite, but to augment that purchase with something that interests you. So if that's a certain style, because that's the thing, craft beer is a choose-your-own-adventure. You can go down almost any flavor route. It can work with any kind of food if you pick something up. It can introduce you to a whole ecosphere of businesses that are connected to community, and you know there's so much of an overlap with craft beer in the community. So sometimes it's just getting people into the overall craft beer world, then the adventure is their own. I would always just suggest, pick up or do a mixed six pack at the store where you can try several breweries, but also try several styles. Keep your old standby, and you know, maybe that stays for a while or goes away, but I know plenty of people who keep both in the cooler.
And I would say over the last few years, there's been a shift in craft beer where before, really, craft beer stuck with the ales, like pale ale, your India, you know, IPA, your India pale ales. And they were doing that because those are a lot quicker to make. And so you can use your equipment a lot, like more efficiently. But what we've seen in the last few years is really an explosion of craft lagers. And so I think for really maybe the first time ever, there are beers that will be familiar to people that have never tried craft beer before. And so...
And really well done.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great point.
And so I would just get in. You're going to find something at a brewery that tastes similar to what you want. And then, too, like, tap rooms are such a reflection of the communities that they're in. I think that if you're out traveling or even if you're at home, the best way to get in touch with what a community cares about and to meet locals is to get into a tap room. And if you're not into beer, that's okay. I think a lot of tap rooms see themselves as community spaces, and so they have other things for you to drink. We have slushies here. We have non-alcoholic options. Like, tap rooms really are becoming a place to gather. And so, don't let not having knowledge of craft beer or anything like that stop you.
I'm going to have to bring Dad a couple new lagers.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to do. We'll be right back.
Just as I was starting my medical training, I came down with an autoimmune disease that led to cancer. I needed a liver transplant. Fortunately, I got one from someone who registered as a donor. As a physician, I understand the barriers to organ donation. Some people think their organs are too old or just don't want to think about dying. But one organ donor can save up to 8 lives. People who register as donors are heroes. And I'm here thanks to my hero.
Be a hero. Be an organ donor. Register today.
I want to thank those of you out there that are organ donors. I know it seems like a slam dunk to become one. Some just don't know the process. You can go to organdonor.gov, or you could even register through the health app on your iPhone if you have an iPhone. But again, if you've already registered, thanks so much. I know I bark and scream and try to get people to become an organ donor. I know many of you already are or have become one. So thank you. And again, if you haven't, it's organdonor.gov. And we are back at Ozark. And we continue to be at Ozark, I should probably say. And this is when we get into the really, really good stuff, the beer. This is, people are already in the tap room, as you can probably tell in the background, and so are we. But we got to start off with the BDCS. And for those of you who don't know what the BDCS is, it's award-winning. It's been around for a while. It is barrel-aged double cream stout. And listener, if you're not familiar, people line up around the building when it's released. It is a very, very popular thing. When did it start?
First brew was in 2014. It came out in 2015, September of 2014, because I had just started, maybe a couple months earlier. And one of my first, things I came to get random pictures on, like a Sunday afternoon, Andy was transferring from the barrels to the kettle, and so I got a lot, or to a fermenter. So that's where I got a lot of like my earliest pictures. And it started then, and we, it aged about 10 months, and then. What we were doing then was Lacey really wanted something that, because we had 4 or 5 taps, and our goal is to be a brewery that, you know, you can find something that you love here that you can drink year-round, that you can introduce to others, but also to have things that, you know, stand out or separate. We couldn't stay open if all we did was BDCS, but having a world-class lager and a world-class pale ale that are well-received made breathing room for this. And Lacey really wanted to have a party. You wanted an event around this. And
a celebration.
A celebration. Yeah. And Andy wanted, you know, to brew this beer, and I wanted to tell people about it. So we had to figure out what we were going to call it, what we could legally put on the can, what we could get away with an acronym. So yeah, it started in 2014, really as a beer to create a celebration around.
It was really our first small batch. And for the first, 3 years at least, maybe 3 or 4, we would individually write out BDCS on all of the labels. Like, we left a little, like, box for it.
The first 2 years.
Yeah, and we would write it out by hand. And so it was very much, like, a labor of love. And it's wild, you know, because I do think that, like, beer, people being excited about beer releases has grown a lot since we did that. And for us, the first couple of years, it really was like, this is a celebration for us. This is a big beer. This is something that we really love and put a lot of intention into. And it grew really organically. And I think we have a lot of, you know, folks in the community that were into craft beer before maybe it was super mainstream here, who took it and said, like, this is really good, and started sending it out to their friends across the U.S. And so that's how, by the time that we brewed it the second year, there was some demand for it, where people were looking to get it. We didn't have it around for very long, and then it just kind of grew from there.
We had a... exactly. A lot of people had sent it off. And so that first year was, you know, I think we sold 120 tickets or so. We had a little jazz pianist. We had a, you know, barbecue Sweet. Smoker. We had some ice cream, cheese. We had Onyx in there making coffee. And, you know, we sold out of the tickets, but it was like just mostly because people who had been following the brewery were looking for a party there. Of course, they liked the beer. They got a 4-pack of it. The next year, we brewed it, you know, and I'd been tracking it online. I'd noticed that, like, it would show up in weird places. It'd show up in Japan. It'd show up in England. It'd show up in Montana. And so it's like, oh, okay. But we're not brewing any more. We're brewing the same amount. We're heading right into this storm. And we were kind of trying to figure out what it would look like. You know, we had seen, both of us having lived in Chicago and other beer markets, had kind of seen stuff like this happen before, but, you know, didn't really know what Arkansas wanted to do or what the travel would look like. And we got an email from a gentleman in Kansas City, and it was like, I'm coming down for the BDCS release. Will you have security? And I got back. Do you remember that? And I was like, what? And he's like, I just don't feel comfortable. Like, in some of these beer releases, like, people get too, you know, whatever, out of line.
But aggressive or something?
Aggressive, yeah. And I assured him, I was like, no. I was like, we don't have security. We're not going to need that. And I was like, but we are going to take steps to make sure it's as fair as possible. And that's, I think we all were, you know, there's a bit of like, what's up with this guy versus like, what does he know we don't know?
Exactly. I was going to say, oh my gosh, that's unfortunate and funny.
Yeah. And then that was the 2016 year. And from then on, like, for those next few years, we didn't brew a whole lot more, kind of the same size. We sold it the same way. You got to come to the tap room to get it. And that's why people were lining up, because they didn't know for sure if they were going to be able to get it. We had to limit it to a case per person.
Sure.
We had to do sorts of things. We had, you know, people who'd try to fake it or get fake IDs. It was so strange. we were able to increase the size of the batch and then start doing the pre-orders online. So we were trying to remove that anxiety for the guests, where it's like, yeah, we don't make a lot of it, but you will know for sure whether or not you get it or not. And so we've done that for the last 4 years now.
Okay.
And I think this year would be the first year we kind of return back to some of those earlier years in terms of the batch size being a little smaller and distributing less of it, if not none of it. We're not really sure, I don't think.
Well, I'm glad you brought up batch size, because small batch production, I know you had mentioned that it was, you know, out of necessity. Pardon me, necessity. I'll get it right. I have not been drinking beer, by the way.
I have.
Out of necessity with COVID, but it's now permanent place. And there's got to be a lot of strategy behind each small batch that you brew. And How do you navigate that? How do you strategize that?
I think, kind of going back to what Marty said, a lot of the direction that we have is really because of those COVID years. And so we were putting out so many small batches during that time period that we were able to see what really resonated with people. And so we took what really resonated, and then we've made those kind of long-term seasonals for us. So we have like LTO, the Mexican lager, Ludacris, which is a Pilsner, and then our IPAs, 40 Miles from Denver. Those were all, we have one Amarillo by Morning that we've put out quite a bit. Those were all kind of born out of that period.
We were running up against like the reality of like people really wanted these, but the market can only absorb so much, or the retailer can only absorb so much so quickly. So a lot of those were a bit of like internal compromises where it's a small batch, but it's going to be around a little longer. So people can plan for it in the market in terms of stores, large stores too. And then that gives us the breathing room to say, okay, then we're going to have really small batches. You know, so then that's tap room only, or a handful of kegs that we'll never see at liquor store.
Yeah.
And I will say, when you look at small batch for the tap room, that's really decided a lot by the brewers. Like we have
100%, yeah.
Really, really talented brewers that have styles that they really like, and they like to make over and over and try different things. And so I think that we're really lucky that we do have enough breathing room that we can give people a lot of autonomy over what they want to make and what they want to see. And so, yeah, there's not a whole lot of like,
oh, it's not coming
planning
from
or anything that it's goes not into the small batches.
Interesting.
And to me, that's the most important thing we can protect, or I could work to protect as a marketing branding person. Like, I've heard too many horror stories of not just breweries, but companies that are led by marketing, and everyone down the chain, it's either love it or hate it. You know, we're so lucky to be in a position where we have the equipment, we have the talent, we have the raw materials, we have the bandwidth, we have the community, we have the tap room. That I've been around beer since I was 4 years old. My dad was working on breweries in Chicago in 1985.
Nice.
Like, I've studied beer marketing, I feel like, my whole life. I love beer. I could go back there all day with a list of beers I want to see. I have to date never done that. And I say it's the cauldron of passion. And it's like, if we can do everything to protect the cauldron of passion, we're going to get things out of that we all enjoy. So you know, when you're drinking one of our beers, it's something we want to drink. It's not something we saw on Instagram, you know?
Sure.
And so like, we've done stuff where we certainly co-pack, we certainly partner, we collaborate, we work with large groups like Crystal Bridges to bring something to life. That stuff we enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. But like she said, and it sounds like crazy almost, like not, but like if Brandt tells me he's brewing a Hefeweizen or a pale ale, it doesn't matter. It's like either one you're excited about, it'll fit. Yeah, it's not like we got to have three of these, two of those, one of those. We'll get stacked up on farmhouses. We'll get stacked up on IPAs. It's fine.
That's awesome. Any small batches you guys want to announce today? I mean, this actually goes up next week, but you know, anything that.
Yeah. Last about 7-8 days ago, we released Star Party, which was designed and brewed by the women of OBC using a yeast that was genetically modified through the CRISPR gene editor by a scientist, a woman from California. And we did it for a Women's Day event here. And
awesome.
It was one of the bigger IPAs that we've done, one of the more scientifically unknown ones we've done. We've used some inputs that we weren't familiar with and methods that haven't been fully tested. And so we have repropagated that yeast, and we're doing a pale ale with it. We're calling it Remedial Astronomy, and that'll be out probably in a couple weeks. But yeah, I mean, if you look at our list right now, we're really lucky to have what we got.
I'm so glad you said that, because I want to talk about what's on tap here in the tap room and rotations, how that's decided and how that's done, and you know, what are the old standbys that have been here and will continue to be here, the stuff that people come in and they better have what I've had for the last 8 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Versus what's brand new.
Well, you can come here any day. You can get a world-class pale ale, the American pale ale, our Ozark lager, our cream stout, and then we used to do our Belgian golden, and now we've got, I mean, our lager, IPA, APA, and stout are really our year-round. We do Onyx coffee stout in the tap room.
Awesome.
And then you can. There's some things you can always expect, but they vary. So you can always expect what you might call more rustic beers, beers that are brewed with, you know, maybe less process in terms of the centrifuging or using wild yeasts. We have a cellar beneath us. We're always trying to produce something from our cellar in terms of a blend that's interesting, or maybe a fruited version of one of those beers from the cellar. So you can always, almost always, which is huge for us. We always wanted to do that, but some of these beers are aging for 3 years. Some are aging for 2 years. And yeah. So we're at a point where these barrels are really bearing fruit. And Brant, who really heads up that project, he is not usually one barrel for one beer. It's if these three are in an area that are talking to each other and asking for something else. So you can always find something in that world. And then of course, we've got our Ozark cider, which is just delicious. We're keeping ciders on.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then, you know, we love our pale ales. We love our hops, but we're not a big IPA brewery. We don't do a whole lot of IPAs, mm-hmm. but when we do, we really try to knock them out of the park.
Yeah, for sure. Any upcoming promotions that you guys have coming up? I say coming up, of course, keep in mind like a week from now, right?
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, we're actually in the process of like, So we have a lot of events in our tap room, and we try to see them as like big community event, you know, partner events where we host people in the tap room,
right?
Or small events that we host. You can kind of drop in, and throughout the month, about half the days we'll have something going on. One of our next things we're working on right now is a dog adoption event for June. Yes, yeah, they work great with the Humane Society. Like, just
love
they're
that.
Awesome. We just had this weekend. Of course, this will air right after. We're having a half K race, which is a race around downtown, 19,000
sure.
inches. And then, you know, moving in through summer, we will have our BDCS release. We will have our big Oktoberfest this fall, which is shutting down the street. And we're also working with a friend of mine, Anthony Ball, who just opened a music venue here called Music Depot, and he runs a nonprofit called Music Moves. And we're going to be announcing a Soul Fest pretty soon. It's his sort of brainchild that we're helping bring together. It'll be bands, food, vendors, all downtown, free to the public.
Right on.
Just something that's not happening down there right now.
That's great. That is awesome. So where can they find you guys, online and in person?
OzarkBeerCompany.com or at 109 North Arkansas Street, downtown Rogers, or at good beer getting places across Arkansas, Southwest Missouri. You find us in Central Arkansas, quite a few places.
I like good beer getting places.
I've started saying that, you know, because it's like that means liquor stores, restaurants, bars. You can even get us in some bad beer getting places, which is fine.
It's okay.
Awesome.
We've all got to get them somewhere, right?
It's awesome.
What about social? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say you asked about the moment we quote unquote made it. It's a joke, but I did have a we made it moment. I was doing something out by War Eagle. I was setting up like Saturday morning. It was 10 a.m. I'm going back and forth to the car to get ice. And I texted Lacey a picture. I saw a picture of our pale ale can that had been littered. And it broke my heart. And then it had been littered and smashed on the side of the highway. And I was like, God, we made it. Do you remember that?
Yes. That's hilarious. Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. I know you all are super busy. And time is money. And a lot of times, time is more than money. So I want to thank you both, Lacey, Marty. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
my pleasure, guys. And remember, please, tip your servers. We'll see you next week.
Cheers.
Bye-bye now.